The next case on the calendar today is State of Minnesota versus Cody Lane Peterson. Council will each have 15 minutes for your argument. If you can please introduce yourselves and the client you represent when you begin, I would greatly appreciate that. And feel free to adjust the podium as needed. And counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can proceed when you're ready. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of appellant Cody Lane Peterson. Mr. Peterson's probation was revoked and his 3 consecutive sentences for a total of 60 months were executed following his first probation violation based on the district court's clearly erroneous factual findings and its abuse of discretion in applying the Austin factors. The first way the court abused its discretion in revoking Mr. Peterson's probation was that the violations alleged were not proven by clear and convincing evidence. Specifically, the failure to remain law-abiding and of good behavior violation, as well as the failure to complete the domestic violence program. The next way the court abused its discretion was that the finding that the violations were intentional and inexcusable. The failure to complete the domestic violence program. The court made a specific factual finding that appellant could have been more diligent in ferreting out his insurance issues and the domestic violence program.
Counsel, going back to the issue of the law-abiding behavior, is there any case law saying that a court can't take judicial notice of another court's order, of this OFP order, in a probation revocation hearing? I mean, is there any case law saying that that's not okay?
There's not any case law saying that a court may not take judicial notice of the existence of an OFP. And we're not arguing that the court shouldn't have taken judicial notice that an OFP existed, but that's all that the court was permitted to take notice of, that there was an order for protection. Although the court did rightfully exclude
the order for protection include a finding that there were threats of harm and assault and battery against the petitioner for the OFP?
So not during the probationary period, Your Honor. The OFP was based on the allegation that there were threats of harm. The OFP was not based on any allegation that he had engaged in assaultive or abusive conduct while on probation. The findings in the OFP regarding assaultive or abusive conduct was in consideration of the history that the appellant had with the petitioning party in the OFP, that in 2010 and in 2013, there had been allegations of abuse. There was no findings in the order for protection that any assault or battery occurred while he was on probation, which gets me to my third.
Well, I'm sorry, just going back to that point for a minute. At the probation revocation hearing, your appellant testified, correct?
Yes.
But he didn't dispute the findings in the OFP order, correct?
He didn't dispute that the OFP existed.
He also didn't dispute that he had committed acts of domestic assault as found in the OFP order.
Correct, but those acts were not acts that happened during the probationary period, and he can't be found in violation for a prior act of alleged domestic assault. So there was no reason for him to dispute that. Yes, it was undisputed that he had.
What is the basis for your argument that the acts weren't acts that occurred during the probationary period?
Specifically the language of the order, Your Honor.
Can you point me to that language, please?
It states in number 4 of the order, that acts of domestic abuse have occurred, including the following: threats of harm, assault and battery against petitioner. But the petition itself was based on the allegation that he had made threats of violence, and that's what the state argued, and that's what the findings were. This was based on the fact that historically there had been an allegation of harm, threats of harm or death, and assault and battery against petitioner. There is nothing in the record that indicates this behavior happened during the probationary period.
Including the threats.
Now, the threats are what I would argue was clearly erroneous to base the fact that appellant, by clear and convincing evidence, violated that failure to remain law-abiding or of good behavior violation. And that's because, yes, the threats of violence was the allegation that the state was making based on the order for protection that did occur during the probationary period, but the only basis for the threats of violence was unreliable hearsay. The only basis for threats of violence was from the petitioner making those arguments to a different court, a different jurisdiction, without the opportunity to cross-examine, without the opportunity...
There was an opportunity to cross-examine, wasn't there?
No, there was not.
He just didn't attend the hearing. He knew about the hearing, didn't he?
The record is silent as to whether he knew about that hearing.
Is there any question that appropriate service occurred?
There's no question that appropriate service occurred, but he was not present at that hearing, and that is undisputed.
That doesn't by itself constitute an inability to respond.
He was not.
Right. If you don't show up,
he had the opportunity to cross-examine.
Hearing that you could have shown up at, you can't say I didn't have a chance to respond.
Correct, Your Honor. But that does not make this reliable hearsay. That just makes the fact that he did have the opportunity had he appeared at the hearing.
The petitioner testified at the OFP hearing, correct?
That's not clear from the record whether or not petitioner testified.
Well, the petitioner was present. That's clear.
Yes.
Okay. And the court found the allegations in the petition sufficiently credible to issue the OFP.
Correct. And based on the fact that appellant was not there to challenge the OFP petition.
But appellant could have been and chose, and we don't know why, but appellant wasn't there, and so what? Why would it be appropriate for us to consider that appellant wasn't there when appellant had the opportunity to be there and wasn't?
It's just a factor considering the reliability of the hearsay evidence. Appellant does not dispute that the OFP exists and that he was not at the hearing, could have.
Is it hearsay evidence, though, if the court has found threats of harm?
The basis of the order for protection is hearsay evidence,
But if all we're focusing on is the finding of threats of harm in the OFP, as opposed to the underlying, and not considering the underlying petition.
Is it hearsay if the...
Well, you're arguing, you know, it would be improper to rely on hearsay evidence, but in the revocation hearing, all the court relied on was the OFP order itself, which found threats of harm. Is that really hearsay evidence that the court's relying on at the revocation hearing?
It is, Your Honor. The fact that there had been threats of harm, there's no specifics in the order for protection as to when they occurred. The only allegation that threats of harm occurred during the probationary period came from the affidavit in support of the order for protection, which was excluded, but although that order or the affidavit was excluded, the probation violation report that the court did take judicial notice of on the record contained all of the information that was in the affidavit. It contained the allegations made by the petitioner. Thus, the court had that before the court when making the decision to revoke probation. It had that unreliable hearsay that was contained within the affidavit that should have been excluded. And in addition, the court's finding that appellant failed to remain law-abiding and of good behavior was based on the court finding that he had committed an assault and battery while on probation. The court made that specific factual finding, and that is clearly erroneous, as it is not supported by any of the evidence in the record, nor is it supported by any of the evidence outside of the record, the affidavit for the OFP or anything in regards to the case with
the
order for protection.
Does go on and say there's a finding he made threats of violence and that's concerning because that's what his conviction was based on, was threats of violence, correct?
Correct. The court did make that finding.
And then the court goes on to say, most problematic to me is the lack of domestic abuse programming.
Correct. And defense counsel at the time appropriately argued that the appellant still had until 2023 to complete that program, and he had taken several steps attempting to get into the program. The agent did not testify that appellant had been given a specific date that he needed to complete programming by, nor that he had failed to comply with any directive regarding entering and completing programming. The court made a specific finding that appellant could have been more diligent in ferreting out his issues with domestic violence programming. The fact that someone could be more diligent doesn't establish that it's intentional and inexcusable, and especially taken into the context when he had been on probation successfully for an entire year, had clearly taken steps to get into this program, and this was the first time that a probation violation had been alleged based on that. There were other options to the court other than revoking probation and sending him to prison for 60 months. He could have been given an intermediate sanction and ordered to complete the program by a specific time, and even before it came to a probation violation hearing, in order to rise to the level of an intentional and inexcusable violation, the probation agent would have needed to give appellant some sort of a directive that you must enter treatment by this date or it will be a violation. In that case, he would have knowingly been violating a directive given by his agent, and that would be intentional.
Isn't it true that his probation officer, in fact, for a number of months had no way to get a hold of him? And that the only way that he was found was when the arrest warrant was issued? I mean, there were like, what, 3-4 months there? Three at least?
No, Your Honor. There was a meeting that his probation agent had rescheduled, or excuse me, appellant rescheduled a meeting on February 7th. And that meeting was to take place on February 12th. On February 12th, the probation agent called and left a message with appellant canceling that appointment. So at most, it was between February 12th and then the probation violation report, I believe, was filed on March 20th. So and he was arrested shortly thereafter. So February to possibly April was when his probation was revoked. That would be 2 months. But he was out of contact with his agent possibly a month and a half total. And we're not disputing that the failure to maintain contact with his agent was a correct finding of violation. But whether that amounted to the need for confinement outweighing the policies favoring probation, well, the district court found it did not. The court was very clear that it focused on the failure to remain of good behavior because it concluded appellant had engaged in assaultive and abusive behavior while on probation, which was not supported by any of the evidence in the record, and that its most concerning violation was the failure to complete domestic violence programming, which appellant had taken many steps to complete and was not intentionally failing to complete it, nor was he in violation of a specific directive to complete it by a specific date. And again, the court did find that he could have been more diligent, and that's not an intentional and inexcusable violation. The only published case regarding whether or not hearsay evidence is admissible in a probation violation hearing is the opinion in State versus Johnson. And in Johnson, the court made it very clear that hearsay evidence may be admissible, but it must be reliable. It must be inherently reliable hearsay where the defendant has been given an opportunity to cross. And even if, in this case, all of the evidence contained within the order for protection is considered reliable and was correctly the basis for the finding of violation, the Johnson case went further to say it's important that it's not the only basis for the finding of violation. Hearsay evidence is admissible, but it can't be the only reason someone is found in violation. And here, appellant was found in violation for failure to remain law-abiding and of good behavior based solely on the existence of the OFP. And the court went on to further interpret and extrapolate what that meant.
Well, he also tested positive for THC. Isn't that a failure to remain law-abiding? I know the court wasn't entirely focused on that in terms of failure to remain law-abiding and engage in good behavior, but what about his positive test for THC?
So the court did not use that as a basis for the violation for failure to remain law-abiding and of good behavior. It wasn't alleged as a basis for that. And in addition, the use of marijuana, the extremely low level, he was only 20 nanograms over the cutoff, would not be criminal behavior. Possession of that small amount would be a petty misdemeanor, which wouldn't be a crime. So even alleging that he possessed in order to use marijuana, it's not criminal activity. And the record is also devoid of any information as to whether he had a medical marijuana prescription, which is a completely different issue altogether. But that was not the basis for the failure to remain law-abiding and of good behavior violation. So this court should not consider it as the basis for such. The court also erroneously found that the need for confinement outweighed the policies favoring probation and that treatment could only be provided in a confined setting such as prison. Appellant was never given the opportunity to take part in domestic violence programming in the community, and he had just finally...
That's just simply inaccurate, isn't it? He was given the opportunity. He had a whole year.
I see my time has just run. May I briefly respond? And during that year, he took many, many steps in order to obtain the programming necessary, including complying with the directive from his agent that he first take care of the chemical dependency portion of it, and then he took the steps to get his identification, social security card, and insurance valid, which took him right up to the time the violation report was filed. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Robert Yount appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota as a respondent in this matter. May it please the court and opposing counsel. This court should affirm the lower court's decision because it exercised sound discretion in revoking appellant's probation. And the record makes it very clear that there are five separate grounds on which all of which the court made findings that justify the revoking of probation. It was not providing UAs when directed. It was not staying sober while on probation. As the court pointed out in oral argument, there was one dirty UA. There was not completing domestic abuse counseling after a year of having opportunities to do so. It was not maintaining sufficient contact with his probation agent, and it was not remaining law-abiding and on good behavior.
But going back to the domestic abuse programming, is it true that he was not specifically told, okay, now you've got everything in order, I'm giving you 2 months to actually start this program? I mean, was a deadline set?
Yes, Your Honor. And so if you look at the order for sentencing, it says that he has to complete domestic abuse counseling at the direction of corrections. So that's the direction that he has to comply with what his probation officer says. And the probation officer testified in the probation hearing here that on all five office visits, all of which had to be rescheduled, but at all five of them, she communicated crystal clear to him that he needed to complete that, and that was the primary term of probation that he needed to comply with. And so, for example, if you look at the record April of 2018, for example, she lays out that she spent an hour and a half going through with him, line by line, what the terms of his probation were, and that he needed to complete this specific term of domestic abuse counseling. And so that... In a sense, the expectations of what he needed to do and the time in which he needed to complete it was very clear to him, and he didn't do it. And she gave him an opportunity for a year. He did his chemical dependency evaluation, and then after that, saying that he didn't need anything further as far as chemical dependency goes, then the next step was to proceed with domestic abuse counseling. He needed to complete intake, and he needed to attend counseling itself. She has not received any evidence from him that he completed either of those. Now, at the probation hearing, he offered this kind of protracted story about having insurance troubles and being unable to actually pay for or complete his counseling. At this stage in the case, that's a credibility determination. The probation hearing, the judge that was presiding over it, was presented with two stories: his concocted story about insurance and the probation officer's meticulous notes about when she communicated with him, how she communicated with him, and that she set expectations with him. And the court credited her testimony over his. And For example, that has been found in previous case law that's cited in the briefs. So in State v. Johnson, for example, the case that appellant cites throughout her brief, that involved a DWI, a person who committed DWI was placed on probation, committed a second DWI. The court there noted that there was a, quote, inexcusable nature of failing to simply attend a program. That's what we have here. He knew he had to attend this program. As the court described as being the most problematic part of putting it on probation was domestic abuse counseling, and he didn't. Now, there's also a finding at this point in time about whether that was intentional or inexcusable. The court, in essence, found that for the first 8 or 9 months when he was not attending, whether it was for insurance purposes or Social Security purposes or whatever purpose, that's inexcusable. That's what the Johnson case says. This is a program that he needed to attend. If you go back and look at the plea hearing, for example, where the state agreed to a dispositional departure because of his amenability to probation for this specific thing, receiving domestic counseling, the court says, am I worried about revoking a DANCO on you right now? I am. But I'm giving you this chance, and I hope that this motivates you to complete this specific term of probation with regard to domestic abuse.
So is it the state's contention that you need intentional or inexcusable, or intentional and inexcusable?
The Austin factor makes it very clear that it's disjunctive, it's or. It's inexcusable or intentional. It's the state's position that it was first inexcusable and then intentional. Because that intentional finding is even assuming that what he said was true with his insurance issues. He resolved those in early January. So as of January, that proffered barrier that he had to completing domestic abuse counseling was gone. As the court commented saying, you should have ferreted out domestic counseling. So at that point in time, there's not only is it inexcusable, but he's intentionally not proceeding with it because there's no barrier to going forward with it. And he has a probation officer saying, you need to complete this. Otherwise, I'm going to submit a probation violation if you don't complete this. And she had that conversation with him in February. And then by April, he still hadn't done it or taken any steps towards it. The second ground that appellant takes issue with and that was discussed in oral argument is that of the remain law-abiding and of good behavior. The good behavior part is what the court focused on, and it is intertwined with the first ground that I just discussed about the failure to complete domestic abuse counseling. That's this appellant's issue. That's the issue this court has with appellant, is domestic abuse. And so when the court...
Probation revocation hearing, the court noted there's a finding he made threats of violence, and there are findings that an assault and battery occurred in the order for protection. Appellant argues that those predate the probation period. Is there any evidence in the record from the probation hearing as to when those threats and findings of the assault and battery occurred?
No, Your Honor. My understanding, I'm kind of backfilling here because it's not in the record, but there was, as appellant pointed out, there was an affidavit that was submitted by the victim in the Kennebec OFP. I imagine that affidavit sets forward. There is in the record commentary or argument from the state saying that these allegations are eerily similar to the allegations that they have with the victim in the current case, the current Anoka case. So that's in the record, that they are similar. But as far as when the assault and battery happened, there's nothing in the record, to my knowledge, about a specific finding of when that happened. However, that does not preclude the court from taking judicial notice of that finding of fact issued by the Kennebec County. It does not take, and it also doesn't erase the fact that...
Do those findings relate to conduct that occurred during the probationary period? And if not, are they relevant to the determination to revoke probation?
I think the record clearly supports the court's discretion in finding that it was within that time frame, because we have to keep in mind, taking a step back, the court felt the need to issue that OFP in January of 2019. A court would not take, for example, assaultive behavior that happened 3 years later, and if that was it, the court would not issue an OFP. Now, again, I'm extrapolating and backfilling a little bit, but we have to keep in mind that a court in Kennebec County issued an OFP during probation. There is presumably a timeliness factor. There presumably would have been allegations, as the state argued here in the record, that are similar to what happened to the victim here about calling and with threatening behavior. And so there is a rational inference of timeliness, the fact that the court made findings of fact and issued its decision when it did, particularly because there was a history already that had been addressed in previous cases. So if you look at the OFP itself, it talks about the previous acts of violence against the petitioner happening in 2013, 2010, and again in 2013. Presumably, this has to be different than those. Otherwise, a court wouldn't address it in a new case. And then finally, just as to clarify with regard to the use of the OFP in the probation violation, the Johnson matter makes it very clear that hearsay evidence is admissible. Rather, it's subject to a reliability argument that probationers have an opportunity to attack that evidence as it comes in. That's exactly what the appellant had here. He had an opportunity to testify at his probation violation hearing. If he felt that it was completely unjust or 100% erroneous, he didn't do any of that. He specifically did not testify or dance into any testimony about the allegations in the OFP. That was his right, but it also means that he didn't contest it, even though he had the opportunity to. And as this court pointed out on opposing counsel's oral argument, the record is very clear as a finding of fact out of Kennebec County that he received notice of the hearing. And while it is not specifically in this record, if you go and look at the record of that Kennebec County case, he in fact requested a continuance. So the record is unimpeachable that he knew about that hearing and that he had an opportunity to attack the allegations that substantiated the OFP if he felt he did. He didn't, and then he again made the choice not to attack it at his probation violation hearing. And then finally, as far as the Austin factors go, the third factor is a balancing test about seeing whether the need for confinement outweighs the policy justifications for probation. And this record amply supports the district court's discretion, including that there was no lesser onerous possibility about keeping him on probation or doing a smaller sentence, but rather than just executing his sentence outright. And beginning with taking a step back and looking at what exactly happened here. He initially had a presumptive commit of 60 months The state agreed to a dispositional departure at the court's discretion, given his amenability of probation, of taking domestic counseling. That was specifically the ground that the court recognized in the plea transcript, saying as, I'm worried, but you've shown amenability to probation with domestic counseling. He then didn't complete the domestic counseling a year after on probation. And as I stated at the outset, this is not just one or two violations, as appellant has alluded to. There were five separate, specific grounds of violating the terms of his probation. The court made clear findings of fact on all of those, and the record amply supports it. So this isn't just one or two technical violations. Rather, this is a constellation of violations. And then finally, looking at the timeline of what happened in probation, his probation officer testified that they had five office visits. Every single office visit had to be rescheduled. She testified that it was difficult remaining in contact with him. Now, Your Honor, Siegel raised the fact about how many months were they not able, or did she not have specific contact for him? My count is a total upwards of about four or more, because she testified at the hearing that from November 18th to January 19th, she did not have a stable address or phone number for him. He was kind of drifting, and then he finally told her that he was staying at his cousin's and aunt's. And then after February 7th, when he stopped communicating with her and stopped appearing for his hearings, she did not have any contact with him. So that's 2 months plus another 2 months just a month later. So you have 4 months at the back end of his probation where he's now drifting. She doesn't know where he is, and she doesn't have good contact for him. And around that same time, you start to see a breakdown of him complying with all the terms of his probation. In early January, that's when he has the dirty UA. In January or late December, that's when he does not take the UA that he's directed to take. And then the next UA that he takes is dirty. And then February, he doesn't take his UA as directed. And again, at that point in time, by his own testimony, his own convoluted story that the district court didn't credit, he had insurance. So now he has all the tools in his kit that he has to have in order to complete domestic abuse violence or domestic abuse counseling, and he still doesn't do it at that point in time. And the record is very clear that the probation officer had a conversation with him on January 2nd saying, you need to complete domestic abuse counseling ASAP. You need to commit and provide UAs as required ASAP. So at the discretion of corrections, she's informing him, saying, you've had some leniency. I've been working with you. I've been meeting with you outside of work hours, but you need to do these. Otherwise, we're going to end up in court on a probation violation, even after that clear directive.
So does the record show what you actually need to do that to get into domestic violence counseling? Is that just a matter of calling somebody, or how do you do that?
The record does not establish that. The record does talk about going to the Lee Center, having to do an intake, and then attending counseling as kind of two separate thresholds. The record is also very clear that he had to complete controlled substance abuse evaluation first. The idea is you have to be clean before you proceed to counseling.
So does the record show he didn't call the Lee Center?
He says he called the Lee Center. He says that he attended intake, and he says that he had counseling scheduled. But the terms of his probation also require him to show proof of that to his probation officer, none of which he provided. She didn't receive any proof or validation that substantiating his statements to her. And again, the court, at this point in time, is a credibility determination. She found that he didn't take the steps necessary in order to complete the...
Hadn't he moved by that point so he couldn't get to the Lee Center? And was any evidence that he actually was looking? And I'll ask the appellant's counsel as well.
Yes, sir. He does, again, it's based on his testimony. He says that he moved out of his mother's house, I believe, in December, and that he kind of had unstable housing. And then by January, February, he was staying with his cousin, I believe an aunt, and that there was some problem with transportation. At this point in time, however, the court didn't find that credible. I mean, the court could have looked and said, I find, there were valid excuses for not attending, and I'm going to give you a little bit of leeway. The court didn't find that. I see my time is concluding here, but it's just, if you look at the established case law, the published case law, they recognize that that's well within the court's discretion to look at the circumstances and then make a determination if it's inexcusable and intentional, and if on balance, confinement is appropriate. So unless the court has any other further questions, I just ask this court to affirm the trial court's decision.
All right, thank you. Rebuttal by appellant.
Respondent focuses on the fact that appellant's probation agent gave him a clear directive to complete domestic violence programming. She did give him a clear directive to complete it, but there was no end date for which it needed to be completed by. And I would direct this court's attention to the unpublished case, State versus Crosby, where this court overturned a probation violation where Mr. Crosby was directed to complete sex offender programming as directed by agent, exactly the same condition here, but with domestic violence programming as directed by agent. And because in Crosby, the agent didn't specify an end date or a specific inpatient program that must be completed, they reversed the finding of violation. And that's because due process requires that individuals be given fair warning of what actions may lead to a loss of their liberty. Here, appellant was not given fair warning that the issues that he had and his, as the court found, failure to be as diligent as he could be in getting into domestic violence programming would have resulted in him going to prison. He was never told that you must complete it by this date or you will be going to prison or I will request you will go to prison. That was not a fair warning that appellant was given. In addition,
here you argued that he had until 2023 to complete domestic abuse programming. What was the basis of that argument?
He was given a 5-year probationary period, and 2023 would be the expiration of that 5-year probationary period.
But you agree that that the specific term was that he completed at the direction of corrections?
Absolutely. And so he was taking those steps to complete it at the direction of corrections. And again, he had been given no specific end date by his corrections agent. If he had been, then he would be violating completing the program at the direction of an agent. I would like to point to the very clear findings that respondent focuses on from the court. The court says that it found a condition of probation had been violated, failure to maintain contact with probation, the lack of communication from, at best, February 7th to April 8th, which is not 4 months. the missed meetings, the rescheduled meetings, the failure to report current information, the failure to report the incidents that came out of Kennebec. There were no incidents that came out of Kennebec. It was the OFP, and the court used his failure to report the OFP as a violation. It was neither alleged nor proven by the evidence in the record, and it's not a condition that he report the existence of an OFP. The court also found him in violation for failure to do the UAs, and then the court said there are findings that an assault and battery occurred in the order for protection, and there's findings that he engaged in threats of violence. That certainly is not good behavior. Those were the findings that the court made based on the record before it. Several of those are not supported by the record. Some of them were not even alleged by the state. The state never alleged that appellant engaged in assaultive or abusive behavior while on probation. And had the state had evidence that he had engaged in assaultive or abusive behavior, I would hope that they would allege that as a violation, as it's a very clear condition that you must remain law-abiding and not engage in assaultive or abusive behavior. And the state had every opportunity to meet its burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that appellant did, but it neither noticed it as a violation nor presented any evidence in support. All the state provided was an order for protection to claim that appellant had engaged in poor behavior, not even failure to remain law-abiding. But the state had the opportunity, even the agent had the opportunity, to contact the petitioner that requested this OFP. And the agent admitted on the record that she never even spoke to the petitioner nor attempted to reach out to the petitioner. And again, while hearsay evidence is admissible in a probation revocation hearing, it should not be the only basis for a finding of violation. That is what the Johnson court clearly stated. And in addition, when the state does not allege nor provide any evidence to support a finding, that is an absolute abuse of discretion by the district court. The state did not allege that appellant engaged in assaultive or abusive behavior while on probation, and the court found that he had violated his failure to be of good behavior condition by engaging in assaultive or abusive behavior. Respondent also argues that the findings in the order for protection that an assault had occurred, behavior had occurred in 2010 and 2013, the fact that the order for protection was filed presumably means that it was not based on that behavior, but that it was based on assaultive behavior during probation. There's no evidence in the record to support that assertion either. The OFP was based on an allegation from the petitioner that appellant had threatened her over the phone. And that's what the state said they were concerned about that was similar to this offense. And again, that was hearsay, the only information that was provided to support that allegation, and there was no argument that he engaged in any assaultive behavior while on probation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. We will issue our decision within the statutory time period. Thank you.